good evening to the latest Perspectives on Ocean Science lecture here at the Birch Aquarium at Scripps. My name is Dr. Nigella Hilgarth, and I'm the Executive Director of the Birch Aquarium. And we're just delighted to have you all here this evening, and it gives me enormous pleasure to welcome our speaker tonight, Dr. William Gerwick. Just earlier this evening, Bill Gerwick told me that his connection with Scripps goes back even further than I thought. He first came here on a high school program from the National Science Foundation to actually learn about oceanography. So he says that he's had a very long love of Scripps since that time. He did his undergraduate degree at the University of Davis, UC Davis, and he did his undergraduate research within phycology with Dr. Norma Lang, and then he came here. He was a graduate student at Scripps Institution of Oceanography, and he worked with Bill Fennecle, many of you know Bill and have heard him speak in this lecture series. And his main graduate research was in marine natural products. And then he spent a year doing postdoc research studying the biosynthesis of microbial antibiotics, so that he really was broadening the scope of his research. He spent over 20 years as a professor at Oregon, and then he came in 2005. He came as a professor of oceanography here at Scripps Institution of Oceanography. He also has an appointment as professor of pharmaceutical sciences at the Skaggs School of Pharmacy at UCSD. And he's also a member of the Moores UCSD Cancer Center. Apparently, his love of the ocean and marine algae actually started even before he did his high school tour of Scripps, as a kid poking around in tide pools. And I think that's one of the ways in which a lot of oceanographers really started their love of the ocean. His lab now really focuses on marine algae and cyanobacteria, which are often known, as I'm sure you know, as blue-green algae, but they're really they're bacteria. I was fascinated and a little jealous to learn that his group works in wonderful parts of the world, as well as locally. They do extensive field work in the Caribbean, the South Pacific, and reading earlier this evening, I see that they have recently gone to the tropics as well. They've actually gone to Madagascar, Panama, Papua New Guinea. They collect a lot of their samples by snorkeling, scuba diving. I was in totally the wrong area of research. But seriously, Bill and his group have really identified a lot of very exciting compounds with pharmaceutical potential from these algae and these blue-green bacteria. And they also collaborate with many other people to detect potential for fighting cancer, neurological conditions, and tropical diseases. So this is extremely important research and extremely exciting group of organisms that he studies. And so without further ado, I want to ask him tonight to talk to us about pharmaceutical treasures from marine pond scum, discovery of new drugs from the sea.
Well, thank you for that very nice introduction, and also let me thank Cheryl Peach for the opportunity to speak about some of our research here tonight. As you can imagine from knowing a little bit about my history with Scripps, you'll recognize and I think appreciate how exciting this is for me to be standing here before this audience in this location and give a talk about our research. So it's really with great pleasure that I share our results tonight. I particularly have enjoyed this flyleaf cover from an old Smithsonian volume on the sea, as the painter of this painting has depicted an undersea scene that has captured something of the fascination that I think we all feel for the sea, the exotic nature of the organisms that live there with their unique adaptations. Now, I've actually never personally seen this one up here, but I have seen some of these others. And they have long fascinated me. And in the 20 years or 25 years that I've had a chance to study these in greater and greater levels of depth, coming to recognize that they're just as exotic and just as unusual and fascinating at their underlying chemical and biochemical levels. And that's really the source of the inspiration and the excitement that we feel about searching these organisms for drugs from the sea. I also, with my title, poke a little fun at our own work that to some, they would look at these blue-green algae drifting around in the sea and think that this is pond scum, you know, it's kind of ugly stuff. No, to me, they're beautiful, gorgeous creatures for their metabolic capacities to make an amazing diversity of really exciting molecules. Now, before I go on with the talk, I would like to do two things with this slide. One is really acknowledge that I'm having the great joy and opportunity to talk about the research tonight. It's really these folks that are doing the work and really want to acknowledge and make sure that that's appreciated. I also want to make note of the fact tonight is September 11th, and we're at our five-year anniversary from terrible events that transpired. And I look at this group of people, and as you know, I moved here about a year ago from Oregon, and we're excited. We're enthusiastic. We're really having a lot of fun being here at Scripps, and I'd like to offer my thoughts that we should meet some of the tragedies that have befallen us and look with enthusiasm and excitement about what we can do and contribute. One area that I feel that we can contribute beyond the scientific one is in the area of training and promoting knowledge of our culture and interaction with people from various countries. So in my group here, over the years, we've had people from many parts of the world, from Japan, Tatsuyama, from England, from Sweden, Germany, Italy. So a very diverse group of people. And for tonight's talk, I took a few moments to recap that from the period 1984 to 2006. People that have been in my laboratory during that time have come from all parts of the globe, although there's a few absences I'm working to correct. But a lot of students from the United States, obviously, but from throughout, from Panama. I have a postdoc right now from Panama in my laboratory, from elsewhere in the Caribbean, extensively in Europe. One of my first graduate students was an Iranian individual. He now lives here in San Diego as a very fine scientist in a local biotech company and doing very well in his life. Extensively in Asia and Southeast Asia and Africa. I'm tremendously proud of a student, Eric Andrianosolo, whom I first met in Madagascar and later came on a Fulbright scholar to my labs and is now a very fine scientist. So I think we can do a lot in another arena, that is promoting something of the United States and knowledge of each other through scientific mechanisms. Well, back to my talk. The oceans, you know, are 70% of the global surface. They have a tremendous biodiversity of organisms, and that biodiversity represents a huge resource of organisms and of genetic capacities to produce molecules that could be used as drugs to treat human disease. And I know this is well known to you all, but let me just recap a little bit of the logic behind some of this. First, we all appreciate having effective drugs. When we go for treating an ailment that we might have, we want a safe, effective, and hopefully low-cost drug. And there is this expectation that drug therapies are going to increase in time, that they're getting better, and they're getting more accessible to all of us. So that requires a continued effort by a wide range of scientists in many different disciplines to really bring drugs from the inception of a discovery all the way to the clinic. And my eyes have been open and continue to open to how complex that process really is. Natural products, though, have played a key role, a crucial role, in inspiring us and teaching us about different kinds of organic molecules and how those might be useful as medicines. And just looking at the track record, some 45% of our best-selling drugs actually owe their origins back to natural products, and 37% of all drugs in the clinic today derive from natural products. So the marine environment is very rich in species. A lot of these former discoveries come from terrestrial plants and microorganisms in the soil. And now we're seeing, from the last 20, 25 years of effort, an increasing number of compounds coming from the sea that are going to be or already are useful in treating human ailments. So if we a pie chart can illustrate this perhaps even more effectively. This is from a fairly recent review in a Journal of Natural Products. where these green pie sections of the pie illustrate those that fraction of our anti-cancer drugs that come from natural products. And you can see it's fully about 40% directly come from natural products. A growing number are biologics, which are very effective drugs, these proteins and other classes of molecules produced by molecular biological techniques. They're also very expensive drugs, and that's one of their limitations. These other various sections of the pie are in various reds and pinks, represent different kinds of synthetic molecules, where synthetic chemists are creating these molecules at the bench. Where are those chemists getting their inspiration? Well, some very knowledgeable folks at the National Cancer Institute that created this review tracked back these various synthetic compounds and realized that many of them, they also owe their origin to natural products. They were inspired by a molecule that had been found in from a bacterium, a plant, or a sea creature, and then a synthetic chemist had created a molecule that was effective in treating disease in humans based on that molecule molecular structure. This is another part of that review, and it tells a disturbing trend, I think, and that is as we look at this by year, the number of drugs that have entered the market. Again, reds and pinks are the synthetic compounds, and green the natural products, and the biologics are an increasing fraction of the arsenal of compounds we have to treat disease. But the trend is, and this has been noted in many publications from the pharmaceutical industry, there's a downward trend in the number of new agents that are coming through the pipeline and are hopefully going to ultimately become effective drugs to treat disease. And why is that? Well, a few years ago, there was a sense that natural products were too expensive to explore further. It's a long process. The average length of time from a discovery to a marketable drug for starting with natural products is about 15 years. That's a lot of investment, and it's not really fitting in the paradigm of modern drug discovery in the pharmaceutical industry. They converted to using something called combinatorial chemistry, where they use random methods to make millions of different compounds and then test those for biological properties. Well, this downward slope of this line tells you what happened or the outcome of that experiment. It's not been effective. It's not been a good way to discover new and effective medicines. And so just recently, we're seeing a resurgence of interest from many different arenas to explore natural products as a source of those inspirational molecules in drug discovery. And I'll be speaking later this year at the American Geophysical Union to a large audience of folks that would like to, and also at the American Cancer Researchers annual meeting, to groups that would like to hear more about the search for drugs from natural products and this resurgence of interest. So, where are we going to find these new molecules? We're accessing new kinds of genetic materials by looking at the oceans. And to date, a lot of our work has really occurred in the very shallow water, so there's quite a lot of excitement of going into deeper water and using new types of technologies to access these organisms. What kinds of tools do we need to investigate these types of environments and technological advancements to get there and get samples back in living condition and effectively explore their biological and chemical capacities. We're also looking increasingly at shallow water tropical environments, and while they have been investigated, they are so rich we really don't fully appreciate how many species exist in these tropical reef systems even now. New species are a source of inspirational molecules, and I would say marine microorganisms are the great untapped resource at the present time, because we can only culture a very, very small fraction of those bacteria that live in the sea. And my colleague at Scripps, Bill Fenichel, has made some tremendous discoveries and advances in that area. But marine macroorganisms, such as the macroalgae, are still many of them live in unique environments that are difficult to access, and they haven't been effectively explored for their chemical capacities yet. So I'd like to just give a few examples, not from my own research, but from others. A friend and colleague at Harbor Branch, Amy Wright, and her laboratory discovered from a deep sea sponge collected with a deep sea submersible, this sponge Discodermia. They found the extract when it was used to treat normal cells. The cells looked like this, where they're stained for their tubulin. Tubulin is the protein that's involved in separating the chromosomes at mitosis to make daughter cells. And what happens in the presence of this drug she discovered, discodermalide, it causes those microtubules to bundle up and hyperpolymerize, thereby killing those cells. And it has a very nice selective activity to cancer cells. Here's a molecule that involves a bit of a sleuthing effort that went on in the over a number of years by various laboratories. My colleague down in Arizona, George Pettit, collected the sea hares. It's kind of hard to see against this background. They're camouflaged. These go around and they munch on lots of algae, particularly cyanobacteria or blue-green algae. And they ingest as food, but they also ingest their natural products. And this is one such compound that the sea hare is ingesting. It's a very complex lipopeptide that was named as Dolostatin 10. And this is a very potent anti-cancer compound. Kills cells in infinitesimal small quantities of the drug are needed to effectively kill cancer cells. And right now, various analogs of that molecule are being created. So the inspiration is coming from nature, but to make a good drug, it needs to be modified so that it has proper distribution and absorption characteristics in the body. And as I mentioned, Bill Fenichel has done some amazing things in the last few years with his colleague Paul Jensen to isolate various new strains of bacteria from the sea. This particular strain gave rise to this unusual tricyclic molecule named selenosporamide A. And this has a novel site of action at killing cancer cells. It's a proteasome inhibitor. And there's a great deal of excitement in the local company here, Nereus Pharmaceuticals, is advancing this. It's in clinical trials right now, a very early stage phase one clinical trial for treatment of cancer. So what we're seeing are a growing number of really very exciting molecules coming out, mainly focused on treatment of cancer. So work in my lab is basically in this area of discovery of new compounds, particularly with an anti-cancer focus. We're also interested in neurotoxins from the sea, both from the point of view of how those might be useful as neuropharmacological agents, but also to describe something about the marine system and how some of those compounds are actually injurious to us and we should know what they are. Also, anti-inflammation is an area we're interested in. And I've always been interested, going way back to my time with Bill Fenichel as a graduate student, of how these algae and cyanobacteria, how are they making these molecules? How are they, these are really pretty exotic and unusual structures. How do they create those molecules? And the intervening years have given me a set of tools and a great set of students to explore some of those questions. And I'll share some of that with you later tonight. So, a little bit about marine cyanobacteria. You probably well know that these are some of the most ancient organisms on the planet. They can be traced back in the geological record some 3.5 billion years. They're responsible for creating the oxygen that changed us from an anoxic to an oxygenic environment. And they have a variety of forms, from unicellular forms that sometimes accumulate into colonies. They can have very small genomic sizes of about 1.5 million base pairs, to some very much more complex organisms with differentiated cells and a lot of very unique functions. And these have larger genomic sizes of about 10 million base pairs. And they're abundant in throughout the planet, many different environments, aerial, terrestrial, aquatic, and marine. And they do something, of course, the reason for my interest and enthusiasm is what they do in their secondary metabolism. So these are molecules that aren't involved in the basic life processes of reproduction and structure of cells and energy metabolism, but rather these are molecules that are adaptive in their significance. They're molecules that are warding off predators or giving them an advantage over competitors in this very competitive shallow water tropical environments. So they make an amazing diversity of natural products. They integrate acetate, which is the precursor to fatty acids, and amino acids, of course, the precursor to proteins, and they make these use those building blocks to make an amazing diversity of molecules. Using these two different kinds of pathways and integrating them together, and then doing a number of other what we call tailoring reactions. So you build the basic molecule framework, and then you come along and decorate it with other functionalities, like something that is very unusual in the marine environment are halogens. In the terrestrial environment, we don't see so many natural products that contain chlorine and bromine and iodine. In the marine environment, we see a lot of use of chlorine and bromine in particular, such as in this molecule here we discovered a few years ago, hectachlorine, with its geminal dichloro functionality. It's a very unusual functionality. What kinds of enzymes are involved in creating a dichloromethylene group? This is more like a functionality that's associated with DDT and man-made molecules, and we use industrial processes of very high energy to create those molecules. How are enzymes making these molecules? That's of great interest to me, and ultimately to harness the capacities of these organisms to make molecules, we need to know that information. There are also some trends in the pharmacology of the molecules from marine cyanobacteria. They're very typically quite toxic to cells, mammalian cells, and they show some selectivity in cancer cells because they hit a couple of important targets in cancer cells and normal cells. But there is selectivity in anti-tubulin and anti-actin compounds. So this is meant to be a little bit of an overwhelming slide to show you some of the diversity of kinds of molecules that we've discovered over the last really about 15 years. And that many of these are indeed are cytotoxic to cancer cells, and they occur in many, many different kinds of molecular patterns. I think you can well appreciate, even if you're not a chemist, that these are very different kinds of structures. They have different kinds of arrangements of carbon atoms and nitrogen atoms, which are sort of the backbone of the molecule, and then a lot of diverse functionality like these. And I've accentuated the use of halogen atoms, the vinyl chloride here and here, to the gem dichloro we just talked about, to a trichloromethyl group. Again, what kind of enzyme makes a trichloromethyl group? That's really a very perplexing question. To then some extraordinarily complex compounds here with a vinyl bromide. And this is a molecule of particular note we discovered a few years from an organism from Jamaica, called it jamaicamide. It has this terminal carbon-carbon triple bond, an acetylene, with a bromine attached to that. That's essentially never been seen before in the natural world. Again, what kinds of enzymes are making that? And I think this gives you a sense of the excitement that we feel as natural products chemists for exploring these creatures for their chemistry. They really make some very unusual molecules, unlike anything we've seen in the terrestrial world before. So let me give you an outline of the process that we go through to discover these molecules. As Cheryl mentioned, we get to start out in the sea, out in making collections really worldwide. I'll show you a little bit more of that shortly. We preserve for chemical investigations directly. Some of these occur as large tufts that we can pick up directly. Others, though, they occur in very small quantities in the sea, and we need to collect them living, bring them back to La Jolla, and cultivate them in a laboratory we've designed for just that purpose. And we also increasingly now are preserving them for their DNA, as we're learning how to work with that genetic rootstock and capture some of the biosynthetic capacities out of that preserved DNA sample. We, from that, either from the culture or the chemistry, we get a biomass that we can then extract for its lipids. It's like extracting mint oil or something like that, except this is seaweed oils or cyanobacterial oils. And then we test those broadly for biological properties. Here at UCSD, we're having some very exciting interactions with the Moores Cancer Center, as was mentioned in the introduction. But we have a large number of collaborators in all facets of science. And when we find something that's very active, let's say with our testing with Novartis Pharmaceuticals for cancer, we get an activity back. Well, that's an exciting day in the laboratory. And we then use various types of chromatography. This is coming from a crude extract that's very complex, many, many different molecules in there. We want to know which one molecule is giving rise to that cancer cell toxicity. So we'll use the assay to guide that process to the active compounds. And then we can say it in two words, but this can take perhaps years to accomplish, elucidate the structure of that molecule. Those molecules I showed on a previous slide, those are quite complex and very challenging to figure out what those structures are. Those are new to human knowledge, and we have to determine those structures by fundamental principles using some very good instrumentation, which UCSD is really has in tremendous abundance. And that's really then the starting place for lots of other areas of investigation. How do these molecules work? What is their pharmacological mechanism of action? How are they killing cancer cells? Can we make that compound? Do we want to make it? I think we do, because we need access to these molecules in larger quantity if we're going to test them in additional models in mouse models and on up, hopefully eventually into humans. How are these molecules made? The biosynthetic process. Chemical ecology. Why do algae make these in the first place? What good? They spend a lot of energy creating these molecules. For what purpose? And if we're going to develop any of these into a pharmaceutical agent, there's a lot of effort that goes into pursuing that and assisting that and being a promoter of it. It doesn't happen on its own. I had an experience some years ago with a pharmaceutical industry that we bring through this process, we bring these leads to the table, and the industry people around the table would scratch their heads and think, well, we can exclude this one because it's kind of greasy. We can exclude this one. So they were looking at ways to exclude from further consideration so that they had less work on their table. You have to be a proponent of these molecules in that situation and push them forward, or somebody's going to say, no, we've got a better lead over here. Okay, I thought also for this audience it could be useful to see and put this in some perspective. That drug discovery effort that we went through in the previous slide, that's really the starting place. Here, a discovery-based program, which is finding new chemical types with a desired biological property. That's really the starting place for what you're perhaps thinking in drug development, is we then go through a preclinical evaluation for efficacy in animal models, and we do some toxicity evaluation. Then we have the phase one clinical trials, which are very early stages. They're basically used to establish a maximum tolerated dose in humans. If one sees efficacy in a phase one trial, that's fantastic, but it's actually not usually a requirement. Usually the study's designed in ways that you're really just trying to see what dose should this be given at to see a safe dose in a human. Phase two trials is where you're really looking for efficacy, and that's still in a fairly limited set of patients. Phase three trials, where we evaluate for efficacy in a much larger group, is where we start, where the pharmaceutical industry would get very, very excited. There would be a diverse set of patients there, and it would be compared to existing agents, typically. And finally, then that would lead to clinical application of a new agent. So this is why it's really a 15-year process. It's a very complex and involves. Well, current estimates for development of some classes of agents is someplace around $700 to $800 million to take a drug from discovery all the way to the clinic. So the world is our playground. We make collections, as I mentioned, around the world. This map is really a wonderful one of the terrestrial environment. I wish we had such a map for the sea. This is mapping biodiversity of vascular plants on the land masses. And it does tell an essential story that is reflected in the oceans, but perhaps not on a one-to-one degree. But generally speaking, in the high latitudes, we have lower biodiversity. In the tropic belt, we have high biodiversity, as indicated in reds and purples. And areas of high biodiversity means we have a lot of species in the same area that are all competing for space, for sunlight, for substrate, for nutrients. That's interspecies competition is what is believed and has been shown in quite a number of cases, is what is stimulating the production of all of these very fascinating molecules that we've been studying. So our collections have been at these locations from the South Pacific, Papua New Guinea and Madagascar, as was mentioned, in South Africa, as well as extensively in the Caribbean, and from my previous days in Oregon, we did a lot of collections up there. And we collect out on some beautiful environments out on this reef crest. That reef crest is actually dead coral, but it's rather soft to walk on because it has a thick layer of cyanobacteria, which are especially adapted to the very high sunlight conditions of that kind of a tropical environment. We also use scuba diving to collect some of these cyanobacterial mats that occur. This is actually about 60 feet of water off the Pacific coast of Panama. And we could roll that thin veil of cyanobacteria and collect it into these bags, or other times it's just small turfs that we're able to collect small amounts of cyanobacteria. These are the kinds that we need to bring back to the laboratory and culture if we're going to get enough biomass to study their chemistry. The mangroves are also a very, very rich environment for us. Of course, the mangroves in Papua New Guinea are sometimes a little iffy to dive in. That's where one has the saltwater crocodiles. And we occasionally see these guys too. So we bring these organisms back to the laboratory, and we treat them as microorganisms, and we grow them on petri dishes as well as in these multi-well trays, and isolate from very complex assemblages of cyanobacteria into individual species, and then we grow them up in the laboratory. And I think they're beautiful creatures. It's like emeralds on a string. These are the heterocysts, the site of nitrogen fixation, and this one, known as Hormothamnion enteromorphoides, and it makes some very interesting natural products. But we grow these up in the laboratory in flask culture initially, and then into these pans. Others of these, some people think that's not a beautiful cyanobacteria. I think that's a... And then we take it into our modern chemistry laboratory. This is actually the pharmacy museum in Heidelberg, where some of the very earliest pharmaceutical research took place. Now we have a beautiful set of laboratories down at Scripps, and we're just about to move into some additional laboratories up at the Skaggs School of Pharmacy. So it's very exciting to have access to the beautiful resources and facilities here. So we test broadly for biological activities. As I mentioned, we're really focused on cancer. We have a long-standing interaction with Novartis Pharmaceuticals, very sophisticated screening against the newest targets that are being revealed in cancer cells. We also have another NIH-supported grant with this individual, Fred Valeriot, in Detroit, and we're doing some work in our own laboratory as well as with the Moores Cancer Center. Agrochemicals with Dow AgroSciences, screening for insecticides, herbicides, and fungicides. Neurotoxins with a colleague down in Georgia, using various techniques, including more recently a flipper assay looking for calcium mobilization in cells as a general indicator of neurotoxins. And we do some tests in my laboratory. I have a very fine technical staff that's working in that area. We do some anti-inflammatory and antimicrobial screening, both at UCSD as well as, I should add, in Panama, where we're screening for anti-malarial, Leishmaniasis, and Chagas disease treatments. And the star of the performance in my laboratory and tonight is this organism here, Lingvia majuscula, known as mermaid's hair, but probably more aptly known as fireweed. Many species or strains of this particular organism, Lingvia majuscula, as you contact it with any duration, it will cause some ulceration of the skin. And it's given rise to things like swimmer's itch in off the shores of Hawaii and Honolulu. So it's found in the tropics, subtropics. It is associated with degraded environments, so that's a concern to all, but it's actually a boon to us. There's more cyanobacteria for us to collect. And it is an extraordinary producer of natural product structures. So I'm going to tell you a few stories that illustrate this. There's a little bit of chemistry in here, but not so much, and I think it won't dissuade anyone from the rest of the talk. These bays on the leeward side of Curacao, Curacao has a lot of environmental degradation problems owing back to many years. I think during World War II as a crossroads in the Caribbean, it had suffered a lot. But there are some bays that are rather pristine still and have these fringing mangroves, and this is a rich source of cyanobacteria that we've collected over the years. And we collected one there that had some very good toxicity to three different models of potential functions that these compounds might show in nature, warding off fish, so anti-fish toxicity, warding off marine mollusks, so fish snail toxicity, and warding off other kinds of small arthropod herbivores, so we used the brine shrimp model. And this particular extract was very, very active. So we then went about our sleuthing of what's the active compound. And amazingly, these activities separated as we separated the compounds. This is depicting a chromatography. Chromatography is nothing more than when you use some black ink on paper and you get it wet and it separates into blue and red inks. That's chromatography. We're doing the same thing at a more sophisticated level to separate out those different kinds of molecules. And when we did that, in the least polar materials, we isolated these brine shrimp toxins, which turned out to be very, very potent cell toxins, cancer cell toxins in particular. And these molecules are very unique for this juxtaposition of this five-membered and three-membered ring, and I'll have more to say about those shortly, because they've become exciting leads as anti-cancer drugs. But this extract illustrates something that I think is quite phenomenal, how rich these organisms are in their natural products chemistry. From slightly more polar fractions, we have these molluscicidal toxins, They're very unusual compounds. I actually showed you the structure earlier. It has a trichloro methyl group, and they have very good molluscicidal activity. From even more polar fractions, we isolated some complex cyclic lipopeptides, and these are fish toxins at a par with the fish toxins that are found down in the coasts of Florida that cause so much fish toxicity there, and millions of fish to wash up on the beaches due to a compound known as brevetoxin. This molecule, which we call antilotoxin, is just as potent as that molecule as a fish toxin. Some other fish toxins of different structure from more polar fractions, and finally some other cancer cell, not toxins, but anti-proliferative agents. They hold cells in a stage of non-proliferation, so it's not dividing. And these are quite unique linear lipopeptides. So one extract yielded all these diverse compounds, all this structural diversity. That's a gold mine. So, as I promised, I would talk a little bit more about Curacin A. It's been an important lead for our laboratory for a number of years now because it's a relatively simple structure. This sort of looks a little bit like a drug in terms of its size. It's a little bit lacking in polar functional groups, so it is a little bit greasy, but it is very effective in treating cancers in certain types of animal model systems. And it does have this very unusual juxtaposition here, which is a part of its essential biological properties. It's exceptionally potent at inhibiting tubulin, that same protein that we talked about earlier, from operating. It works by a different mechanism, and it's active at 1 to 10 nanomolar. How active is that? Well, it's like putting about a drop of this compound into a swimming pool of cancer cells and killing all of those cancer cells. It's that potent. This is a very, very potent compound. And it's under some continuing development now that I'm down here at UCSD by the Moores Cancer Center. They're looking at including this molecule into little nano machines that would go in, search out cancers, and deliver a spectrum of anti-cancer agents directly on a cancer, which is a very exciting concept, and I'm excited to be a part of that. So here's just, again, depicting the mechanism. We have a normal cell division process, and so we have, at this stage of mitosis, the separation of the chromosomes in dark are organized in a microtubule network that organizes and provides the motive force for pulling those chromosomes apart. And that's the process that's so potently interfered with Curacin A. So, as I mentioned earlier, I'm very interested in how these molecules are being created, their biosynthesis. And so, with these cultures, we were able to bring this back from Curacao in living condition, grow it in the laboratory, and then feed in precursors like the amino acid glycine or these components that are the precursors to fatty acids. But we incorporate, or we fed them into the cultures, not as the normal form that occurs in our bodies, but rather in a form that's enriched in certain isotopes. Oceanographers for years have used isotopes as a way of tracing processes. We use it in a slightly different way. We buy these acetate enriched with C13 or amino acids enriched in C13 or N15, feed these to cultures of the organisms, watch their incorporation into the molecules. If we choose these correctly and properly, this molecule goes in and enriches some of the carbon atoms or nitrogen atoms in the backbone of the molecule with that isotope. And then we can observe that by nuclear magnetic resonance spectroscopy. So we can really map out how that molecule is being created by a series of acetate units and then the amino acid cysteine and then another series of acetate units to create this overall structure. But how is that occurring? I mean, those are the units, but which comes first? Does it start here and go that direction, or does it start in the middle? How to get that deeper level appreciation for how the molecule is being created? That's where we've had to turn to molecular genetics and molecular biology. And this is a concept slide. It's not 100% accurate, so please forgive that, any of you that are molecular biologists, but I think it illustrates the process quite nicely. Is what we found in the cyanobacteria, and this is true for other prokaryotes, is that the set of genes that codes for a set of enzymes that create these molecules, they're all clustered together. They're not spread out all over the genome of the organism, but they're clustered together physically. And that really aids in their discovery and description. And the way that they work is really, I think, one of the most fascinating discoveries of the last 15 years, is that they're clustered together, and by the process of transcription and translation into proteins, we form a series of proteins that work like a miniature assembly line. These enzymes work in exactly the same order that the genes code for them. And this is a concept of collinearity, and there are a few exceptions, but the rule is a very, very predominant rule, that these genes code for enzyme A, B, C, D, and E, and F, and so on. And the way they work is that they progressively build this molecule from the left to the right. So we start with a little simple acetate, and then it gets extended to a diacetate type molecule, and then cysteine's incorporated and cyclized into that little five-membered ring, and some other chemistry, I skipped a few steps, make the cyclopropyl ring, and so forth and so on. The molecule is created in a series of transformations, and then when the full molecule is present, all along it's being attached to the enzyme as one of these thioesters, it's cleaved off and releases this molecule, curcumin A. So we've in fact gone in to study this in the case of curcumin A. It's a fairly complicated process. I'm going to go very, very briefly over this, my apologies, but we extract the DNA from the organism, and that actually took us about a year to figure out how to do that well. We then chop up all that DNA into little pieces and stick it into E. coli and make a so-called library, so that collection of E. coli has all the DNA that was originally in the cyanobacterium. And then we design some probes, which is a little complicated to describe, but it allows us to target certain sections of the DNA that we would recognize as having part of the curcumin A gene cluster. And a lot goes into that probe design. That's where I think the big advances have occurred there in this field in the last few years. And that allows us to probe this library and find the section of DNA that encodes for curcumin A. And then we can use sequencing to simply sequence that DNA and a lot of bioinformatics to understand what are those enzymes that are encoded and what are their presumed and possible functions. And so we did this for the curcumin A case, and here are the series of enzymes, each represented by a small dot with an abbreviation for the kind of metabolic capacity, the enzyme reaction it's catalyzing. As you can see, this is quite an assembly line, and it's completely linear from the gene sequence to the set of proteins that then catalyze a series of reactions that progressively build this molecule curcumin A. Where we are now with this kind of study is studying in depth how does this several novel features of this molecule, like the cyclopropyl ring, is created in this series of steps. And this is the first time that particular set of genes have ever been seen in nature. And we really don't understand how they work. And so myself and a colleague in Michigan, David Sherman, are studying in depth the mechanistic biochemistry of how those enzymes are creating that cyclopropyl ring functionality. Okay, on to another story. As mentioned, we make collections in Papua New Guinea. We've been going there since the late 1990s to different sections. Many of my students have joined on these, as well as actually a member of my family has been on one of these trips out into the eastern fields out in this region. We've had a lot of great collections and great projects come from this. But one in particular is shown here, and it's one of current interest to us. This is maybe from about 30 feet down to 100 feet. We'll dive down, and on the coral encrusted, very complex assemblage of organisms, there'll be holes in the reef, but they'll be covered by this thin veil of cyanobacteria, and that's maybe that big around on the sea bottom. And if you were to stick into this with your fingers, you get a large popping, snapping. And what it is this doesn't grow naturally as a cover to these holes. It's being stitched in place by a shrimp, a snapping shrimp that lives underneath there. And this is its protective cover, and it defends it quite vigorously. And you can actually, a student or two have gotten drawn a little bit of blood from one of those one time. But it is a cyanobacterium, typical cyanobacterial morphology. It is actually a Lingbia, a different species, Lingbia bolognii, and it's very, very rich in its chemistry, and we've been studying that for a number of years. And this is one molecule that we're very excited about. The history is shown here. We and another group in Hawaii discovered the molecule at the same point in time. Dick Moore, a giant in this field at the University of Hawaii, and Dick discovered with his students this molecule at the same time we did up in Oregon. And we've been pursuing it. They found no in vivo anti-cancer activity. But in our work with this individual I mentioned earlier, Fred Valeriot, we found it was very potent and selective cytotoxin. And Fred has some different ways of looking at these cytotoxins, and he found that this cytotoxin, that the way that they had done the assay previously by Dick Moore, that they had used the wrong schedule and dosing regimen, and they would never see activity given some of the properties of the molecule. So this is a very exciting lead for us. Actually, the student Hendrik Lutsch is continuing to study the mechanism, and he and I are working in some collaboration there. But it's a very high priority lead for us. We're re-isolating the compound. We're cloning the biosynthetic pathway because I didn't mention that, but that's one of the goals of that cloning, is not only to understand how they're created, but if we can capture that pathway and that set of genes, we can put it into another organism that we might be able to grow very easily in the laboratory and provide a steady supply of some of these molecules. And we're also working with others on chemical synthesis of these molecules. So now a third story that I'd just like to tell you tonight comes from some of our work in Panama, another site that we've been working since early 2000s, but it's a program that started in 1998. And I'm the principal investigator since 2003 of this program. It's a fairly large program, $3.7 million over the last 5 years, and it's funded through the Fogarty International Center. It's something that's quite unique. It gets money from these three agencies. They usually don't work well together, but they're working very well together under the context of the Fogarty International Center. And it has a very complex set of interrelated goals that it's been fascinating to be a part of this program. And I'm just so proud to be a part of this program because we're combining drug discovery from terrestrial plants as well as marine algae and cyanobacteria with assays that are of relevance to the people in Panama. So tropical diseases, malaria, leishmaniasis, Chagas disease, and also dengue. But these diseases are increasingly afflicting many more people in the world, and malaria, of course, is probably the largest disease by number in the world. We also screen for anti-cancer and agricultural compounds. Isolate compounds and determine structures. And then we also we integrate those goals with developing scientific infrastructure in Panama. Much of this work goes on in Panama, at the University of Panama, at the Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute, and at the national laboratories called IndicaSat, which is a site on the previous canal zone. Very nice facilities. So we are funding a lot of people there, and laboratories are there because of this program. And it's changing the culture of science and scientific exploration in Panama little by little. It also is involved in biodiversity inventories and conservation, economic development, and outreach in Panama. And it's being done with a very keen sense of safeguarding intellectual property so that Panamanians will derive benefit from any of these discoveries. Not only at the end of the process, but during the process, that is, by participating in the scientific research and through training of young Panamanians. So as I mentioned, I have a Panamanian scientist currently in my lab here at Scripps. So Panama, lying east to west, has this amazing set of coastline, both in the Caribbean and Pacific, many, many unique collecting habitats, and a lot of great specimens coming from there. And I'm just going to not really go into any detail, but we're quite excited about these lead compounds. They have anti-malarial activity. They're, again, lipopeptides with a terminal acetylene, so several very novel structural features. The most exciting one is this one here because it shows to Plasmodium, the disease-causing organism for malaria, 6 micromolar, but in the host cell, it is toxic at 182 micromolar. So it has about a 30-fold window of therapeutic selectivity. And finally, as I mentioned, I'm very excited to be here at Scripps and at UCSD for many reasons, including the Moores Cancer Center. Dennis Garson and Wolf Lozado have been exceptional colleagues and have welcomed us to the university, and we've had some great interactions already. Screening our marine cyanobacterial compounds to models for angiogenesis, to inhibit the blood supply to tumors, is a very exciting and increasingly promising therapy for treatment of cancer. And unfortunately, I can't show you the structure, so I made a big red X. That's not a computer problem. But this is probably the most exciting discovery we've had in my career. It's a molecule that was in our compound collection. We sent this up and tested with them, and they kept testing down and down and down, and it was killing all the cells, this model for angiogenesis. It's active to 10 picomolar, so that's the most potent compound we've ever encountered. And it works by a mechanism that may be very, very exciting in the angiogenesis area. So it's already been into a zebrafish model, which is a model that is used extensively here at UCSD and increasingly throughout scientific worlds, and completely stopped the growth of new vasculature in that fish model with no toxicity to the fish at all. So it seems to have quite good selectivity. And we're working on synthesis of this in my laboratory right now. So a few concluding remarks. The cyanobacteria, I hope I've shown, perhaps overwhelmed you with a few slides of chemical structures, but they are continuing to provide some very surprising and unprecedented molecular structures. So this is in the realm of chemical diversity, very exciting chemical diversity, that inherent to their novel structures are very potent biological activities, and they hit some targets that are very exciting from an anti-cancer focus, actin and tubulin, but they're also hitting some new targets, like this molecule I wasn't able to fully disclose in testing with the Moores Cancer Center. And finally, I think by understanding this architecture of the biosynthetic genes, how those molecules are being created through these complex biosynthetic and assembly line type processes, that we're understanding the mechanistic biochemistry of their assembly, and that's providing some new insights into how they're being made, but also opportunities as we learn how to harness that biosynthetic capacity and move it into other groups of organisms. I do have a couple of other final thoughts that I thought I would share with you, is that I'd like to speak to the educational role of what we're doing here, and I think that by this type of research, very multidisciplinary in its focus, we have a lot of collaborations on campus and off campus. It's creating a very compelling educational environment at the graduate level and also the undergraduate level, and we have some undergraduate researchers in my lab down at Scripps. It's exciting to have them involved. That UCSD's students, I think we should recognize, are being sought for top positions throughout the industry and government, academic science positions, and that they become leaders. These are the cream of the crop, and they're going on, they're the leaders of tomorrow. They're going to chart the new directions in drug discovery and some of these research areas. So it's exciting to be involved in their education. And finally, that what's being created and been created with Bill Fenichel and John Faulkner for many years and being restored in and infused with some new energy from myself, Ted Malinsky, a new hire in chemistry, and Brad Moore, as I mentioned, a new hire down at Scripps, is we have an amazing drug discovery program. It is without a doubt the finest program in the world to have this accumulation of researchers. We're all sort of at the top of our game, and we're connected and collaborating in some very interesting ways, and I think it's a national asset that we should recognize and appreciate and see some new ways that we might foster it to engage in some highly synergistic research. So finally, just some names. Current students in my laboratory, I still have one student up in Oregon, but a great group of students down here at Scripps, and research associates, a little bit still going in Oregon, but a group of postdocs in the laboratory. Actually, one postdoc that's permanently located down in Panama with that program, and some other staff members that contribute greatly to the group. And then, as I mentioned, collaborators. My chief amongst these is, of course, my wife, who's also a PhD scientist associated partially with my group and partially on her own research, and visiting professor in the lab, Todd Capson from Smithsonian Tropical Research Institute. He was really one of the chief architects of that program in Panama, and it's been a great association and great to have him visiting this year in my laboratory. But as you see, from around the world, we've had many, many fine collaborations. Other colleagues at UCSD, Scripps, as I mentioned their names a few minutes ago, and this is largely funded by the NIH as well as a few other programs. So with that, I'd like to finish and take your questions. And again, it's been a pleasure to be here tonight. Thank you.